Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Welcome to the show today. I am very excited to introduce my guest. Last week, I interviewed Jennifer Hill Hart from AERO, which is the Alternative Energy Resource Organization. And when I mentioned that my husband and I were interested in biodiesel, she recommended that I get in touch with Bob Quinn. So I reached out to Bob, and today he's here to share his story about his organic farm in Big Sandy, Montana. So welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you. So I think just going through your website, it's full of information. You're doing lots of research. And so I think this is going to have a lot of value to listeners because they're going to hear about some things they probably haven't heard about before.
All right.
So I do always like to, well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself first?
Well, I was raised here in Big Sandy on the 2,400 acre wheat and cattle ranch that my grandfather started in 1920. My father continued to farm between 1948 and 1978. He was here 30 years, and I've been here since 1978 with my family. So we're pushing 40 years here pretty quick. Starting about 1983, I started a flour mill in Fort Benton and with the purpose of marketing our hard red winter wheat and spring crops, spring wheat, directly to whole grain bakers in California. That's what the original purpose was. And we were just selling grain at the beginning. In 84, we added organic grain that we bought from some organic farmers we found in northeast corner of Montana. In 85, we added a flour mill. And in 88, we built our own cleaning plant. And I had about 10 employees, but it was 50 miles away and was always a little bit of a management challenge because I still had my farm. I was farming full time. So I finally sold it to one of my employees, Andre Giles, in 1999. And he has expanded it and done much better than I ever did. So I'm pretty happy about that. And I started converting to organic about 30 years ago, starting experiments in 1985 and planting my first crop in 1986 and had my first 20 acres of certified grain in 1987. I was so excited about our experiments that we transitioned the entire farm in 3 years, and by 1991 we were 100% certified organic and have been that way ever since. So that's gone very, very well for us, and I'm very excited about it and trying to promote transition organic agriculture wherever I can through Montana, U.S., and the world. So that gives you a little introduction. About the same time in 85 or 86, we started the Ancient Grain Project. We marketed under the trademark of Kamut. And that has grown to the point that we now contract with about 150 organic farmers in Montana, Alberta, and Saskatchewan for about 80,000 acres. And we sell the grain all over the world. And the trademark means that it's always grown organically. The Kamut trademark stands for organic production, always pure ancient wheat. And for most people who have trouble eating modern wheat, they have no trouble eating the Kamut brand grain products. And now someone else just walked in the door, so hang on. He has a question. This is my son. He's married to my youngest daughter, and they've been here. How long have you been here now, Andrew?
4 years.
4 years, and he's still loving it. Tell the folks if you like it or not.
That's great.
Can you say hi again? Sorry, because I had turned the record off.
Yeah, hi, everyone. Who am I talking to?
Well, I'm Jackie Beyer from the Organic Gardener Podcast, and so you're talking to my audience.
Holy moly. Hello, everyone.
So Andrew came to me with an MBA and not knowing a thing about producing oil. And I said to him, why don't you come and try us out for a year? And if you don't like it, you can go away with a business creation line on your resume. And so they came. And after 6 months, he told me he figured he's having more fun than any of his other fellow MBA students. And they've been here ever since. So tell him who you supply, Andrew.
So we supply University of Montana, Montana State University, Botany Soap. We are in conversations with a few other big companies. We also do business with Organic Valley, and a lot of local grocery stores and health food stores, and local restaurants as well. One thing that we also do is we get back the waste oil that comes back from restaurants and from the university food services, and we clean that oil up, and Bob has converted one of his tractors to run off of that instead of diesel fuel, and so we displace a lot of diesel fuel costs by using the waste of vegetable oil that comes back from our restaurant customers.
So this is high oleic safflower. It's the best kind of oil for your heart, and it's the best kind of oil for high temperature cooking because it doesn't break down the trans fats very, very, very fast. It has a very long life, and some of our customers told us that they increased their oil life from 30 to 50% based on depending on what kind of oil they used previously. Even though it's a very expensive oil, it actually costs them less because of its long life. So the customers are very, very happy about it, and Andrew's about ready to start bottling it and putting it in the grocery stores in, 750 milliliter bottles? Or
And 500 milliliter bottles.
And 500 milliliter bottles. And in the future, he's thinking of adding flavors to it. So you can be watching for that. But right now, we're selling most of it in bulk. He goes to organic soap about, a third the organic soap, a quarter? How much goes to organic soap now?
Oh, yeah, about a third of it.
And two-thirds to mostly bulk, and most of those are the two big customers in Missoula and Bozeman on each of the campuses there.
And they're using it
right.
In
their food service.
Cafeteria, yes. Like for cooking?
So everything you use oil to cook with or bake, some of them are using it for baking. Salad dressings, anything you'd use, vegetable oil, you can use high oleic safflower. It's very mild to the taste, so it doesn't cover up spices and other flavorings you might want to put with the oil for salads, for example. I use it at home for everything. Instead of butter, I put it on my corn for corn on the cob. I'd use it for everything. So we started with
excellent.
About one press and about 40 or 50 acres. And now we can't hardly keep up with the demand. How many presses do you have now, Andrew?
We have six, and we're looking at getting two more.
And Andrew mentioned Health or Organic Valley, a large dairy co-op, and they are going to be taking all of the mash, which means the leftover after we press. The leftover is called mash, and it contains about 22% protein, about 4% oil. Is that right, about 4%?
9%
oil. 9%, so there's a really high feed value, and the dairies are particularly interested in it.
I like that. I love all of it.
Well,
Andrew
just popped his head in the door, so we just put him on the air. So, you have anything else you want to say?
Look for us in the stores. It's called The Oil Barn.
Oh, yeah. We changed our – I had to get rid of my beef cows because I started traveling in the winter for food shows. My wife wasn't really interested in feeding the cows and calving them out while I was gone. So we sold our cows, and I changed my cow barn into an oil barn. We had to redo the walls and the floors and everything to make it food grade, and now it's The Oil Barn. So you can watch for that.
Okay, excellent.
That was a nice aside.
Yeah. We learned a lot just during that little aside there.
Yeah, so Andrew and his wife, my daughter Bridget, have three little children, and they are now living in the home where my parents live before they moved to Great Falls, right here on the farm. So that makes a nice opportunity for us to see them and the grandkids grow up, and gives him a job full-time. And right now that the oil barn is providing them a full-time living, and with the eye on expansion and hiring additional helpers here in the near future. Especially as he gets into the bottling, it's going to take more time.
Excellent. See, and that was one of the things Jennifer and I talked about. She said she started at Arrow because she was explaining how, green jobs are profitable, and we can, there's that myth about alternative energy not providing jobs, and she's, her big thing when she started there was debunking that myth, and then she ended up moving on to the executive director position. So I just love that because, for a lot of reasons. The reasons we kind of started talking about you was because I was telling her I taught in Browning for almost 4 years. I just recently quit so I could do this and stay home. And when I was over there, I would go crazy when we, you know, we'd walk the kids out to the buses, and you probably know how many buses are in Browning. There's like a dozen of them because it's a huge district with 2,000 students. And, you know, all the teachers are walking the kids out to the buses every day. We're standing out there. A lot of times the buses from the high school are late, so the kids are standing in line with, you know, 8 buses lined up or 10 buses lined up, and the last 3 or 4 from the high school are still coming. So we're out there just breathing in this awful diesel, toxic, you know, when the bus drivers are sitting there waiting, you know, till the kids get released, they all have to be lined up. So it's, you know, there's a good hour at least that these buses probably are sitting there, or at least a half hour, 45 minutes between by the time the kindergartners get on till the high school kids come and everybody's loaded and leaves, because the high school kids get off and then they go to their individual bus and however they work it. And it's just after the smell, and I'm just like, this, there's got to be a better way. You know, and then meanwhile, we're in the middle of the heart of farmland, and I'm thinking, why? There's got to be a way to grow something that doesn't smell so bad, but it doesn't. I'm not sure we're going to get to that solution today, but it. But you're using it in your tractor.
A little bit of the same goal we had. That I wanted to start out. My original idea was to start out by growing my own fuel, but when I discovered that I could sell the oil for, say, $2 a pound. That amounts to $1.50 to $2 a pound. That's $12 to $16 a gallon. So I couldn't afford to put that in. It didn't make a sense to put that into a diesel engine when diesel prices now are less than $4 a gallon. And then I dawned on me, well, why don't just sell it for food first and then take the waste oil? And we just clean it, filter it, dewater it, and we put that in our tractors. So we eliminate the argument of the big debate over using acres for food versus fuel, and by using it for both, first for food and second for fuel, everybody wins, and we get to sell the product twice, and it becomes very profitable, and it's not fair for the environment and for the workers who are breathing, or the kids who would be breathing the exhaust, because it smells like French fries instead of diesel fumes. I'm sure it's much healthier for you.
Yeah. And actually, I was telling her on the EPA's website, the biggest biodiesel right now is a school district down in Nevada that has like 260,000 gallons they use every year or something, or they transport that many. I can't remember the stats, but yeah. And then that's where my husband, he has a backhoe, and he just, you know, wants his backhoe to run on something better than diesel.
Sure.
So that's also his thought. But I love this. So you're growing crops and then selling them for food and then getting the food waste back. That's just awesome. Yeah, and I think that's how they do it down in Nevada. They said they were running on food waste.
Well, and the university loves it too, because they don't have to worry about paying somebody to pick up their waste oil or dealing with it at all. We're just there and we pick it up as we deliver the next lot to them. So it works out very, very well.
Excellent. Well, I don't understand why everybody's not doing this. we'll get there, right?
It takes a little logistics, and it takes, not everybody's, certainly not everybody's growing safflower, and very few are crushing their own seed. But my vision is to try to work out all the kinks and the problems here on the farm, and then put together some kind of a franchise or a model that could be duplicated. There goes. Yeah, that I had from early on was to create a model that could be duplicated all over Montana and even the West or even the country, where farmers could form a co-op of some sort, grow an Ohio Lake vegetable oil that fit their area best, whether that be safflower for us in the upper Great Plains, Ohio Lake sunflower where they get a little more rain, or whatever. Ohio Lake canola, if they want to do that, where it's a little cooler, and process that seed into oil, deliver the oil to the local restaurants just within, say, 100 miles of their town or county or wherever they're located, and then pick up the waste oil back from those restaurants, and then have a central place that would clean it and distribute it out to the farms from which it came. That was the vision in the beginning. What we found so far that there's, because this oil has a much longer life, the return that we get back is much less than we expected. It's less than 50%, because a lot of oil is going out on the food because it lasts so much longer. And so we didn't think about that or consider that in the beginning. So actually what comes back to us is not near as much as we thought, but it will still provide a significant reduction in fuel consumption from diesel on the farms. The interesting thing is that the fellow that developed the diesel engine in the first place in Germany designed it with the idea that it would run on vegetable oil. So that was before diesel was really a commodity or readily available. But over the years, of course, it devolved and transformed almost exclusively to running on diesel fuel. But it can run on vegetable oil without any difficulty.
And there's a big mystery about his disappearance, that diesel guy, isn't there? What happened?
Is that right? I'm not familiar with that one. But I do know the only thing that we have to do to modify our engines now is to put a heat exchanger on the engine, which requires the engine to be started with diesel to heat up, and then the hot water from the diesel engine will heat up the vegetable oil just before it goes into the injectors. And if it's heated to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, the diesel engine cannot tell the difference between hot vegetable oil and cold diesel fuel. So it works very, very well. It has about 94% to 95% of the energy that's in diesel fuel. As far as what is converted to run the tractor, you can't tell any difference. You can't hear any difference. You can't feel any difference when it switches. It's all computer controlled. And when the tractor cools back down, it automatically switches back to diesel, and you need to only run the tractor on idle for about 5 minutes to refill all of the fuel lines with diesel fuel. So the next morning when it's cold, it will start on diesel. Diesel will be already in the fuel lines, and it'll start that way. It'd be very difficult to start it on cold vegetable oil, but it can start on cold diesel just fine.
So that's interesting. You have to kind of isn't diesel kind of like a cold? It's got its own deal where you have to heat it too, sort of a little. Or like I know Mike always has to plug his backhoe in, so it's kind of
In cars they had glow plugs and pickups and whatnot that preheated the cylinders before it started, but in diesel tractors are big enough that they don't do that. And the electric motors that turn over the diesel engine to start it are powerful enough that it can cause the diesel engine to fire without preheating anything.
Okay.
It's very smoky in the beginning, of course, as it warms up, but it'll still start all right.
Okay. So the other thing that I'm just fascinated about is, for some reason at this time of my life, I've been like listening to like a million business podcasts, and just the whole business process that you guys have been going through just sounds fascinating. So, but I'm not sure where we should.
Well, we have about 4 different enterprises connected to the farm. So we have lots of different business models and different business processes. But so far, they're in various stages of success and maturing. The oil barn now is making money for the first time after about the third year. We started a business called Montana Horizons Organic Snack Foods, and our first product is Crackling Kamut, which is taking our ancient grain and making a snack food out of it, similar to corn nuts. We boil the grain. It's a giant wheat, so it makes a nice big size, much bigger than the old wheat nuts used to see in the market here in Montana a few years back. So this is about 3 times that size. We boil the grain in water, then boil it in our fry it in our vegetable oil till it's just slightly brown, and then we spin off the excess oil with a centrifuge so that we meet the minimum fat requirements for school lunch or school distribution. And then we lightly salt it, also with not any more salt than it's allowed for school distribution. We package it in 1.5-ounce packages, and we're just starting to sell it now in some of the stores in Montana, and it'll be available through FFA and 4-H projects to raise money, fundraising projects, this fall and winter.
What's FFA?
Future Farmers of America.
Oh, cool.
And there's a chapter in almost every school in Montana connected with the VOED program, the educational program.
Okay.
Oh, VOED program. Vocational agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, that sounds good and nutritious and fun.
And then the other project we're doing is dry land vegetables, which are more of an experiment, but we're growing potatoes and squash and onions in north central Montana without any irrigation. And what we've learned is if we will spread our plants apart about 3 or 4 times the space that they normally grow under irrigation, they have enough space to grow and water to grow roots where they can get to the water with their roots being spread out, not too much competition. Have to keep the weeds out, of course, completely. And
The weeds out if you're spreading them out so big?
Well, we cultivate everything we can, and then we hand weed what is missed by the cultivation. So it's a little bit labor intensive, but the return is much more than what we can get from an acre of wheat, and it provides another enterprise for the farm and local food for the communities. And it's a model I'm hoping could be perfected here and then duplicated all over Montana or the West at least, because I think that after we get done worrying about fuel, our water will be the next big fight of and the water. The water scarcity will make the fuel shortage look like Disneyland, I predict.
Yeah. I was thinking you are so forward thinking and such a visionary and just really working towards changing our future. I just love everything that I'm hearing. So back to just your very first, I have to ask, so John Tester, our senator, is from Big Sandy, right?
Yes, yes.
Do you know him?
Oh, yeah, very well. We served on the school board together. It was his first elected office, actually, and my last. So our paths diverged at that point, but we remained really good friends. I helped him convert his farm to organic in the late 80s and early 90s, and so we worked very closely with that. He's one of our kamut growers and safflower growers for us, so we spend a lot of time together talking about those sorts of things.
So how does somebody become one of your safflower growers? Is there a certain size minimum acreage they have to have? And how does somebody become a safflower grower that way?
You want to have an acreage that makes sense. Most people's fields in north central Montana are 30 to 80 acres anyway. So a field would be fine. It has to be certified organic. Everything we do is certified organic, so that's probably the biggest criteria. And then we help them. We provide them with seed, which they replace at harvest time. We help them with ideas of how to manage it and harvest and plant it and everything.
Okay, so then the other thing that I've been wondering about is, it seems like you kind of went this way because it was more cost effective for you. You chose the organic almost not as much as a concern about the chemicals and pesticides as it was. It could be totally off about that, but it seems like you got into it because it is more profitable, which is, what I've kind of always felt like it has to be. But
well,
is that not right?
We got into organic because of customer demand. Because our customers were asking for it.
Okay.
And so I find it's, and I've tried it both ways, I find it's very much more, it's much easier to give the customer what they want than to convince them that they want what you have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my philosophy, is to have what they want rather than to make them want what I have. So you can make them want what you have if you have millions of dollars and go on TV every day like Monsanto does and tell everybody how wonderful you are and how they can't live without whatever you have. But if you have a product that has a kind of quality that they can tell the difference and perceive the value of it, they're willing to pay more for it and support you. And to me, it's a lot more fun to do business that way anyway. And it's much more satisfying to provide needs for people than to create wants. So that's kind of the difference. And once we did that, you mentioned about the profitability, it's certainly much more profitable. We're not paying big bills out for chemicals. Our production costs are way less, and the value of what we sell is way more. And even though the volume is not quite as big, what's really important in farming is the net profit, not your yield. And people just want to talk, the chemical companies only want to talk about yields, but yields aren't the most important thing. The most important thing is the net profit. And the net profit is a result of subtracting all of your expenses from all of your sales. And if your expenses are more than your sales, then you are, as most farmers used to do, only profitable by cashing the government check that comes to support agriculture. And that's a very artificial and shaky foundation to be built on.
Excellent. Well, so how is it that your production costs are less than using the chemical company that way?
Well, because I'm using rotations and growing my own rotation to control weeds, so I don't have to buy herbicides. Mm-hmm. We use rotations to discourage pests. So we're not usually having pesticides anyway. And then I'm growing my own fertilizers with legume plants that produce nitrogen, so I'm not growing or purchasing any fertilizers. So without a fertilizer bill and a chemical weed control bill, our expenses are significantly less than my chemical farming neighbors. I mean, hundreds of thousands less. So,
it's huge. So now they always say, isn't it like the biggest problem is though, then if you're growing organically, their big complaint is like, then you don't get as much, it's harder to get that food to the store and on the shelves because it's going to go bad quicker. But you're saying yours lasts longer.
Well, it depends what you're talking about. One of the ways to get it to last longer is to spend more time on the store shelf and less time traveling. It probably doesn't last much difference, but if you're having to pick your food green in California and allow for a week of processing and shipping to Montana, and then you still don't have anything that's close to vine ripe, as compared to picking it fresh one day and having it in the store that evening or the next morning, that's a huge difference. And people are willing to pay more for that kind of quality. We have a neighbor down here on the river, Missouri River, about 10, 15, 20 miles from us, that grows cantaloupe, and their name is Pearson, and people wait all year long for their cantaloupes to get ripe, which they're ripe right now, and they haul them by the pickup load to Great Falls and all the towns in between Big Sandy and Great Falls and around Havern area, and when they have them in the stores, you can smell them when you walk in the store, mm-hmm. and it's amazing, and even though they are quite expensive, people think they are really worth the money, and they're a high-value crop, and people love them. And they don't eat them all year round, however. They only eat them in season, and I think that's the way we should eat. We should enjoy the best of what we have each season rather than try to be eating watermelon in January. This is
exactly
insane.
In Montana.
Yeah, this is insane. If we lived in Chile, we could eat watermelon in January in the neighborhood, but we don't live in Chile. So why are we shipping watermelons from Chile or even southern Mexico to Montana in the wintertime? These are the kinds of things that have set up an artificial fresh food, a continuous fresh food supply that we really it's really more expensive than it's worth, I think. And it's not as we lose nutrition and we lose taste and we just are dependent on too much trucking and not enough of our local agricultural production.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's one of our big things is trying to, my husband's goal is to grow, you know, as much of our food as we can so we don't have to, you know, support that transportation piece and just try to keep it as local as possible.
Sure. And you can dry it, you can can it, you can freeze it. And the first things I started off with my dryland production were really storage vegetables. So potatoes and squash and to a lesser extent onions can be stored for months. The potatoes for us, we can eat potatoes 12 months a year. We can store the potatoes from October to July, and by the middle of July when the potatoes are stored in storage are gone, the new potatoes are on and we can eat them fresh until October, and then October we dig them all and put them in the root cellar and we can eat potatoes all year round. Now potatoes aren't strawberries, But it's a staple. It's a staple that we could live off of and have good nutrition and good flavor and fresh, either from fresh storage or fresh right off out of the field for the whole year. With a squash, we can go with summer squash fresh from the field from, say, July to October or September when it frosts. And then we can start on winter squash, which can last until May at least, and sometimes June with spaghetti squash, our longest lasting squash. They can store, not in a root cellar, but in dry, like in your garage or something where it's dry and not too hot, say 60 degrees or 50 degrees or so. Almost, not quite a year, but almost a year. They'll store almost until the new summer squash are ready the next season. So that's another crop that you can go year-round. Onions don't store quite as long, but they can you can get several months out of them. We can have the same with all the root vegetables. In fact, like carrots and turnips and beets, they can all store fresh many months in our root cellar.
That's what I was thinking. Like I told my husband, I was like, even if you could just supply the school districts with carrots and potatoes, I was thinking that could make a business because it seems like they, you know, they go through tons of those. But I was curious about where would you store them? How would you store them?
They can be stored very cheaply in root cellars. The root cellar is quite deep and has good humidity. It can store a long time. Mm-hmm. And there's almost no expense for that once it's built. Mm-hmm. There's no maintenance expense. We have a little fan that keeps the air circulating and some pump to take out excess water, and that's all that we have. Those things run intermediately.
Cool. Yeah, I just got him some books out of the library on how to build a root cellar. That's like one of his goals year on top of he planted like a little mini farm, I call it.
Well, you'll love it. So,
it's crazy. We finally dug a well last year, so we can do that for the first time ever. And then he planted like a mini apple orchard. Like we have, I think, 14 fruit trees a couple of years ago too. So I can't believe how many apples we get off of these trees.
It's possible to do really a good supply of apples. We have 27 different varieties. The other thing I'm trying to do is do experiments with an orchard and seeing how many small fruits and even large fruits. So berries and apples, plums, pears, and sour cherries. What varieties do best here? In the books I've been studying, there's 200 different apple varieties that are rated for zone 3, and I've tried out about 30 of them so far. So not even hardly 10, just a little over 15% or so of the apples.
You're zone 3 then?
Yes.
Because you're on the east side there?
Yeah.
Because I think we're zone 4 or zone 5 or something.
Well, you got the flathead over there that can grow sweet cherries, so. Mm-hmm. That's a big difference. We can't grow those. But with sour cherries, if you mix a sour cherry juice with apple juice, it's a wonderful breakfast drink that has more vitamin C than orange juice and that we can grow it ourselves. And so why are we supporting, why are we drinking orange juice? There's not a, for breakfast every morning, there's not an orange tree within 1,000 miles of Montana. So why don't we grow something and enjoy something that we can grow here?
I like that, and it's probably cheap. I mean, it's been hard for me to even think about buying orange juice this summer. It seems like it's so expensive. And that would be nice. And even just if you could have orange juice one day and cherry juice the next day, it could even just add in a little different taste and stuff.
Well, it's a little tough to drink sour cherry juice straight. It's extremely sour. But if you would add that maybe 3-to-1 or one part cherry to three or four or five parts apple, depending on your taste. It's a very tangy drink then.
Mm, I like that. What was I going to ask? I forgot.
The other thing we're doing is about a dozen different types of berries. Some are local, like cypress berries or June berries are called, or Saskatoons, depending on where you're living. We also add to that choke cherries and buffalo berries, which are native and grow in our coolies here on our farm. We can make the buffalo berries, we can freeze, and I eat them all winter long. The choke cherries, we can make syrups and syrups out of for pancakes. And, of course, June berries you can use for pies. And then we add to that other berries that we've imported in, like Nanking cherries, gooseberries, currants. We have currants from the coolies, too, that we can make jams and jellies out of. We have elderberry tree bushes. We have sour cherry bushes, sand cherries, and sea buckthorn, which is a bush from the Siberia, whose berries are very strong in antioxidants and have been used in fighting radiation disease in Russia. So that's what I'm looking at for those. Yeah, some of them are very, very powerful medicinal plants.
This is all fascinating. it's just so important because, you know, the whole local piece and look at all these things you've suggested that we can get right here in Montana. You know, people would think, oh, Montana, what are you going to eat then if you don't transport food in? But look at all these different flavors and exciting things that people can make and do. And
Well, my goal has been on my farm to have fresh fruit from May till October. I can pick fresh out of the garden or out of my orchard. And so I start with strawberries, first thing that are available by the end of May. First thing we start with rhubarb. It's really not a fruit, but we make pie and sauces out of it. And that's starting the 1st of May. And then by the time the rhubarb is done, the strawberries are on. By the time the strawberries are done, the raspberries are on. And then shortly after raspberries, or currently with raspberries, we have the June berries and the currants. And then we go to the gooseberries, and then later the sand cherries and choke cherries, and finally the very last ones are the buffalo berries in September. Nice. And then apples, of course, start in our earliest apples at the end of July, and the last one we're picking right after frost in October or mid-October. So plums are coming on in August and September, and our pears the same time, and the cherries are coming off in late July, mid to late July.
Nice.
Yeah, so we have
There's tons of stuff.
Yeah, there is, and we can freeze and preserve that fruit, the excess of that fruit, and enjoy it all winter long.
I like that. Okay, how about, I'm not even sure where to go. I was thinking about tools, because usually I have a question about what's your favorite tool. I know it's a little different for you on a big farm, but your favorite tool is probably your tractor, huh?
Yeah, it's really not a fair comparison. When I was little, of course, the tractors, you were out in the hot sun all day long and in the cold of the spring and the fall, all bundled up to protect you from the cold, sharp winds. And now, of course, they have cabs and they're air conditioned and you can listen to the news
or podcasts.
Yeah, or podcasts. Great. Why not? I listen to study languages, German and Italian in my on the cassettes and the CDs now, and the tractor, and so that's completely changed. We have GPS that even drive it for you in a straight line, so you don't even have to think about that. I'd rather drive it myself, but that's the people working for me now, they all use the GPS. So
you're kidding?
Yeah, that's what they like. They're used to all this computer stuff. For me, it's still a black box, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So.
Yeah, I don't think I would even like that.
It's fun to just also the hoe when it's not too hard hoeing. If you get out early when the ground's still soft and the weeds are small, and you can see the progress you made. We're doing a lot of experimenting with composting and mulching so we can reduce our hoeing of the high value crops, the vegetable and fruit crops. So it is less work intensive. We're finding that we don't have micro labor here. So we don't really have a way to hand cultivate everything. And so we're trying to figure out ways where we can use deep mulching and other things that can really reduce our labor costs and weed control. And at the same time, feed and nourish our trees and plants and bushes.
So how about telling us a little bit about how you decide to run an experiment or do an experiment? Is there a process that you go through? You start with, or even how you decide what you're going to start, researching?
Well, my background is science, and I grew up loving plants. That was my favorite thing. when I was growing up, I was in charge of the garden here at the farm. And even though I helped with everything on the farm, the garden was my favorite part. I wanted to be a plant scientist. I went to Montana State University and studied botany, and then got a master's there in plant pathology, and then went to UC Davis and got a PhD in plant biochemistry, studying a plant disease project. And so I learned very well in 10 years of college the scientific method of how to set up an experiment, how to have controls to make the object of your experiment viable, and so that you can really learn something from it by having controls on your experiments showing with and without your experimental test object, for example, and limiting your variables and all that sort of thing. So I was very acquainted with that and always loved research. And I really wanted to be a research scientist, but I was a little discouraged with academia. By the time I finished 10 years, I found science was quite controlled by people who were, rather than working together, were in competition with each other for grants and money. So they couldn't, most of them were not able to collaborate or work together because they were in competition with each other for the same money. So it really, to me, was a very odd evolution that science had taken because of the way it was funded. So I moved home, and I started very modest in my experiments, but as the Kamut business, when selling our ancient grain, picked up steam and began to grow, I was able to use some of the profits and the money I received from that to fund my own experiments. So now I fund my own research, and I do whatever I want, and I'm not in competition with anybody, and I try to publish and share all the information that we learn with other people who might be interested and can help them.
Wow. Well, that explains a lot.
So I'm interested in general, after the conversion to organic, the best types of rotations, the best types of soil building plants, the best types of weed control, the best types of insect control. Although, as I mentioned earlier, that's not a big problem for us. And so those are just by their nature, gives me an enormous amount to study in my research. And I have good contacts with Montana State University, and there's been many experiments done here under their direction and sponsorship. And also I work closely with the Ag Experiment Station in Havre, and they help me with lots of different things too. And we work back and forth.
Wow. You're a busy guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't spend much time at the coffee shop, I'll tell you that.
All right. Well, is there anything else? I mean, you've shared so much with us today. Is there anything else you want listeners to know?
Maybe I should mention a little bit about our Kamut project. We started out with just what we thought was a novelty, a grain that reportedly was taken from the tombs of Egypt. When I went to Cairo, I found it wasn't true, that it didn't exist in the tombs. That was einkorn that was planted there 4,000 years ago, but it's been in Asia probably 2,000 years, probably brought in by invading armies of Greece or Rome. When I went to Turkey, the people in Turkey told me that this grain had come off of Noah's Ark, and that's what they believed and was their legend. So I thought that was a lot better story than my old tomb story. And in Armenia, they had the same legend. So, you know, what the good book says about anything that's verified in the mouths of two or three witnesses is fact. And so that's good enough for me. So we started growing this as a novelty. And very soon, a couple of people who couldn't eat modern wheat said, well, we have no trouble eating this. And when that happened, when we were told that, then we took it much more seriously. Anyway, after a neighbor said that they couldn't eat modern wheat but could eat our ancient Kamut brand grain without any difficulty, we started trying to figure out what kind of why and trying to do research that demonstrated that. And we tried all kinds of things for years and had a hard time finding anybody in America that wanted to work with me because they didn't believe there was a problem with our modern wheat.
You're kidding.
Well, it's about 15 years ago, and now there's a little different attitude, I think. But still, there's many people that think that there's not a problem, and this is all in people's heads. But the research now shows that 10 to 20% or 12 to 20% of people actually do have experienced physical problems when they eat modern wheat. The wheat-free, gluten-free diet fad, it much exceeds that, and that's what's making it a fad more than a real response to difficulty. But meanwhile, I found a team in Italy that was very interested in working with us, and since that's our biggest customer now, about 65% of everything we grow, over 80,000 acres in North America, goes to Italy. They were very interested in the research. We found that partners in University of Bologna and University of Florence to set up a program. And over the last 8 years, we published about a dozen papers. We found that compared to modern wheat, the ancient wheat, the Kamut brand wheat is anti-inflammatory. It's has a much higher antioxidant capacity response when a person eats it. And we've done... We started out with a rat study that gave us indications of this. Then we went to a study in healthy humans. And since all chronic diseases are linked to inflammation, we have now been studying chronic diseases. So we published a paper on irritable bowel syndrome. And in that study, people ate either modern wheat or ancient wheat for 6 weeks and then switched, had a washout period for 6 weeks and then switched to the other grain for 6 weeks, not knowing which or what they were eating. They ate the grain in the form of pasta, bread, and cereals and crackers. And that was the only wheat they were allowed to eat. And with irritable bowel syndrome, every single person on the Kamut diet had 50 to 100% improvement in their symptoms. And the modern wheat showed no improvement, and some of them were a little bit worse, but not statistically. We went from there to a study in cardiovascular disease. We found all the aspects we tested in cardiovascular disease was improved, even though these people were all on high doses of medication because they'd all at least had one heart attack. And the professors didn't think they would see anything because of the level of medication they were all on, statins and all kinds of other things. We went from there to this year we're studying diabetes, and that report will be out. I'm leaving for Italy in a week, 1st of September, and that will be an opportunity to get the first report of that. We hope that will be published in by March, February or March. But it looks also very positive. We next want to study obesity because we've seen weight loss with people who switched their diets to ancient wheat compared to modern wheat. We want to study dementia and Alzheimer's disease because there's a direct correlation with inflammation and dementia. So those are some of the things that we're seeing, and we believe that it might be something as simple as changing your diet from ancient grain to, or from modern wheat to ancient or heritage wheat, or at least introducing aspect of breeding programs which check for inflammation with modern wheat. We could eliminate the inflammation causing aspect of modern wheat and improve everybody's health. It would be worth untold, just it's unfathomable how much that would save in health care costs and loss of work and that sort of thing. It'd be untold billions of dollars. So our goal is to develop a cell culture test where plant breeders could, in their own labs, develop their own lines. I'm not interested in owning any of this stuff. And that would be hopefully make, if they're done at the universities, make seed free to the farmers to grow, that would actually be anti-inflammatory and still have some of the modern aspects of disease resistance and higher yields that they bred into the plants. That's the long range vision and goal for that project.
Wow. Changing the world. You know, that's like my motto. Podcasters are changing the world.
And that's the goal. That's the goal.
We're bringing your message out there today. I can't believe so. You're going to Italy, and you're doing all the. I mean, it's just fascinating. What a life! Like, and who would think this farmer from Big Sandy, Montana, is like the global traveler and gonna change the world? You're gonna go to the climate change conference in Paris in December?
Well, I haven't got that on the schedule, but I've got a food show in Bologna in September. We're doing a series of seminars at the World Expo in Milan in October. I have a meeting with my research team back in Bologna in December. In January, we have food shows in America. We attend in February International BioFach, which is the biggest organic food show in the world, held in Germany. in March. We go to the biggest food show in Anaheim in America. In April is the last food show I go to, which is in London. So that's my winter travel schedule. And then I try to farm during the summer and stay home a little bit more. But that's how I spend my winter. I market almost all winter. We've got, if we're talking about the Kamut project, we have over 2,000 different Kamut products now in the market in the world. Our goal, my philosophy is to find the best partners that produce the food and process the grain and let them do what they can do best. And I just supply the best raw material and the research that shows or demonstrates why it's better than anything else and good for you. And that's been a great partnership. And this little snack business we've done in Big Sandy is actually the first time I've ever done a retail product. And it was my first idea to do something like this 35 years ago, almost 40 years ago now. And since no one picked up on it in 40 years, I've decided we just do it ourselves in Big Sandy. So that's what we're doing.
Excellent. is it like, you said, what's it like? Corn snack. Oh, I know.
It's like corn nuts without your dentist, because it's more like the consistency of Rice Krispies, but it still has the flavor of and crunchiness of wheat.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, it's lightly salted. You'll love it. So okay. We'll send you some. We have a website you can go on.
You do? What's your website?
Yeah. Crackandkamut.com.
Let me pull it up here.
No, make sure if this is going on the air, we have to have it right.
Yeah. And we'll put the link in the show notes, but it's always good to tell them.
Yeah, the website is now is able to go on and not only hear the story, but order for us too. With my wife, should get that.
Yeah, Bob, it's cracklin.com.
So it's cracklin with a K, cracklin, K-R-A-C-K-L-I-N, and then kamut, K-A-M-U-T.com.
Cracklin.com.
And you can go on there and order right off the website until we are available in your local store.
Okay, excellent.
So all my research and my wheat deals, and I don't know if you want to put this on the air, but it's how I think. I study Monsanto a lot, and I try to do everything the opposite of what they do. So that's kind of our goal. We are diametrically opposed to GMOs and the control of the world's food supply. We're trying to make the world's food supply more available and more locally produced in a better way, which is organically grown for the local people rather than create an international food exchange sort of system that we have now.
I like that. I still think, I don't know, lately I've been thinking we're going to get Monsanto on board with us because organics has got to be the way to go. And
well, I think it's the future. It's the future. And some of the companies that maybe are a little more visionary and not so much focused on trying to control the world's food supply and by controlling the world's seed supply, have converted to organic production, or I mean producing organic inputs that help farmers grow organically.
Mm-hmm. You mean like fertilizers and things like that? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Like inputs? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. For inputs of organic weed control, pest control, and that sort of stuff. We don't use many of those because our crops are fairly, not high input and they're low value crops. Grains are normally relatively low value crops, but if you're growing strawberries or fruits or vegetables that are very high value crops, then you can afford to have inputs to help you with those.
Now, so what do you do about pests? Do you just not get a lot of pests, or?
Well, we get potato bugs on our potatoes, and we use BT extracts from the bacteria Bacillus thuringiensis, and that is toxic to the potato beetle in its pupate stage and in the immature, the juvenile stage, and that controls potato beetles. Other than that, we really don't have. We've also sprayed Nosema locusta, which is a protozoa. It's an organism that's between a virus and a bacteria in size, and that will affect grasshoppers and give them a the disease that kills them and the other grasshoppers eats the dying grasshoppers, and it spreads. If you have a huge swarming invasion of grasshoppers, it works very well, spreading from one to another through the whole swarm. It doesn't act immediately, so you have to control it before it gets to your field by spreading bran infected with this protozoa around the edge of your field. And as they eat it and enter the field, you might lose 20 or 30 feet, but by that time, the grasshoppers are sick and dying, and your crop is saved and spared. Anyway, sorry about that. Anyway, let's see. So as far as weeds go, of course, we don't have something as simple as a burn-down herbicide, but we are able to keep weeds under control by rotations and competition with our main crop. We have if our main crop has a good start and a good solid canopy, the weeds are at a disadvantage. The big advantage the chemical guys have is when something goes wrong and you have a very sparse crop, it's not well emerged, or drought or something has caused the loss of a partial part of that crop, and then you have a lot of space for weeds to grow. Then we're at a big disadvantage, and if we have a lot of weeds at harvest time, we have to swath the grain instead of straight cut it so the weeds dry out before we can thrash it and combine it.
Interesting. Okay.
So we have things that we can do that are kind of stop gaps, but the best weed control is a very good crop cover.
Did I lose you?
Nope, I'm still here.
Oh, right. The best thing is to have healthy soil, right, and a healthy crop.
Well, and the healthy soil produces a good crop cover. So the big difference between chemical agriculture and organic agriculture is that we focus on feeding the soil rather than feeding the crop, mm-hmm. and we let the soil nourish the crop. The soil feeds the crop. We feed the soil. In chemical agriculture, the focus is on feeding the plant to the extent that they almost ignore that they're even growing in soil. So they provide everything they think the plant needs instantly at the time it needs it. This makes plants grow in a fast, stressful way, and because they're under stress, they're more susceptible to insects and disease. And so we have a little bit of protection because of the way the plants are growing by themselves. For disease and insects, that's not final protection, but it's measurable. So that is important to us too. But it's a different focus, and the whole idea, the chain that we are linking together is healthy soil to healthy plants to healthy animals and healthy people.
Excellent. Okay, since we're just about to break an hour, ready for my final question?
Okay, I thought we only needed 45 minutes. Anyway, you're going to have a lot of cutting here, I guess, huh?
Yeah, or just a longer show. Because you're just fast. I think listeners are going to love us. You've given us so much information and just really talked a lot about important things for people to be thinking about the way we produce food in America. And also, the best part is you've offered so many great solutions. And just, you know, educating the public is the first step, I mean.
Well, I agree, and I'm a very solution-oriented guy, and part of my research bent is education, because if you do research all day long and never tell anybody about what you learned or what you found out, I think it isn't fulfilling the purpose for which you've done it.
Cool. Completely. I'm actually going to talk to this guy who has a class called is it ILT? Invest, Learn, Teach. And they talk a lot about, I mean, this is another one of those business people, but he's always talking about people invest in themselves, they learn, but they don't teach enough of what they've learned. Well, that's the important part of promoting a business these days, especially, you know, cause there's so many content-based businesses on the internet. If you want to, you know, I hear a lot about, you know, providing value and information is the way to build your business successfully the most.
Yes, and we try to have lots of tours and make ourselves available for groups or anybody like to come and see what we're doing, and we don't have any big secrets, and we try to share what we've learned and hopefully enable other people to do similar things in their own communities or future in life.
Mm-hmm. And actually, the guy that John Lee Dumas, who taught me how to podcast and whose podcast is my favorite, he's always talking. And he actually, you know, created this podcasting group. He loves teaching people how to podcast. And even if they are indirect, he's just like, there's no competition. All ships rise in a high tide. Like, the more of us there are, the better.
That's exactly
right. And it's certainly been a success tip for him, because he's just skyrocketed.
Good. Well, my goal in our business philosophy is that everybody wins, and we feel very strong about that. And we think if everybody wins, then it will always be successful, and it'll just the ripple effect will just go on for ever and ever.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. Anyway, I was going to say, like you were saying before, that we're going to go from energy to water. That's so true. And you're just offering so many solutions for our planet on how we can address those issues, which is nice to hear, because, you know, sometimes it gets a little scary and depressing and we wonder. I love to hear all these great solutions.
Well, I think you got two choices. You can focus on what's scary and depressing, or you can focus on visions that give you hope and excitement and fun and joy. And that's what we've tried to do. For me, the organic farming and all these other enterprises are really a lot of fun. And they're not only profitable, but they're fun doing and very satisfying. People enjoy the products that we produce, and they appreciate having better food for their family. And that's very extremely satisfying. And at the same time, we get a better return from them. And so that's also financially an advantage for us. And the profitability is very important for us to be able to continue with some of the research and the other new directions we're trying to carve out.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you're being profitable and you're doing this research. So everybody make sure you go to, where did it go? CracklingCamet.com and order your... snacks today, because we want Bob to get out there and keep doing what you're doing and spreading this incredible knowledge. I mean, your background is just fascinating, and you're just really changing the world, I think.
Well, we're trying to do it 1 acre at a time, and we got a blog you can tune in on too, that you might find interesting, or some of your listeners might find interesting to follow as we go through the season. The different things we're doing on the farm and how it's affecting us and what we're trying to do in response to unforeseen things that happen to us, whether it be weather or related or whatever. So that's another avenue that people can enjoy.
And is the blog at the CracklingCamet.com?
No, it's BobQuinnOrganicFarmer.com.
Okay.
BobQuinnOrganicFarmer.com. And that should bring up blog and web, Facebook, and all that other stuff. Which
and Quinn has two N's, right?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Bob Quinn with two N's, organicfarmer.com.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, nice. I like that.
Well, time went fast, huh?
No worries. Yes. Thank you so much for sharing your information with us today.
Oh, thank you.
And hopefully I'll meet you at the Aero Expo. In
yes, I think they're coming down to the farm for a tour. Mm-hmm. I need to call and check and see when those are going to be exactly.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for calling. And anytime you want to do another one or focus on a particular subject in more detail, just let me know.
Okay. Have a great day, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's just AWESOMEMONTANA.com, like awesome Montana, all spelled out. And click on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will link right to the show notes and all the things we've talked about on today's show. If you like what you've heard today, we'd love it if you'd head over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. It really helps us get found by other listeners and share the knowledge. Thank you again for listening. Have a great day.